Hello and welcome to The Central Question, a podcast that explores the craft of creative nonfiction, hosted by Sean Prentice and Jessica Hendry Nelson, co-authors of Advanced Creative Nonfiction, a writer's guide and anthology from Bloomsbury Publishing. In each episode of The Central Question, Sean and Jess interview an author from the textbook's anthology to examine the craft strategies involved in the making of the essay. Thanks for joining us as we explore the central questions of creative nonfiction.
Today, we're talking with Vijay Seshadri about his piece memoir and about Chapter 11, Soundscapes. And as always, our guest host is Anna Claire McGrath, our producer and a graduate student in the MFA program at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. Vijay Seshadri is the author of poetry books Wild Kingdom, The Long Meadow, The Disappearances, Three Sections, and That Was Now, This Is Then, as well as many essays, reviews, and memoir fragments. His work has been widely published and anthologized and recognized with many honors, most recently the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, and in 2015, the Literature Award of the Academy, American Academy of Arts and Letters. He currently teaches at Sarah Lawrence College. And just a personal anecdote, Vijay was also my professor and mentor in graduate school, and probably the person from whom I've learned the most about reading and writing over the years. So it's especially an honor for me to get to interview him today. Vijay, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with all three of you and to talk about literature, which is a wonderful thing to do when you're on lockdown.
And just a pleasure for me, since I haven't had the pleasure of listening to you talk about literature in, I don't know, maybe 10 years now. So Vijay, I think before we get started, would you mind just reading memoir for us?
Sure. Memoir. Orwell says somewhere that no one ever writes the real story of their life. The real story of a life is the story of its humiliations. If I wrote that story now, radioactive to the end of time, people, I swear your eyes would fall out. You couldn't peel the gloves fast enough from your hands scorched by the firestorms of that shame. Your poor hands, your poor eyes, to see me weeping in my room or boring the tall blonde to death. Once I accused the innocent. Once I bowed and prayed to the guilty. I still wince at what I once said to the devastated widow. And one October afternoon, under a locust tree whose blackened pods were falling and making illuminating patterns on the pathway, I was seized by joy, and someone saw me there. And that was the worst of all, lacerating and unforgettable.
Beautiful, thank you so much. Vijay, the first question we ask all of our authors, and I'll ask to you now, could you tell us the origin story of memoir? What was the impulse to write it? What in your mind were the piece's central questions?
It was the first poem I wrote after I published The Long Meadow. And as you probably can sympathize with, I was sort of in a fallow period after I publish. I'm always in sort of a fallow period after I publish a book. Somehow I can't really get myself going. And I was sort of banging my head against the wall. And I had gone to an artist colony because I had had a sabbatical that fall. This must have been the fall of 2004. The leaves were falling and the pods of a locust tree were falling. This was at McDowell. And I just noticed those pods of this tree near the studio where I was working on the ground. And that image was the image that occurs in the end of the poem of the the pods of the locust tree, you know, which are the seed casings, and they're large and they blacken and then they fall and they perpetuate the species. And I just saw that image, and somehow that image was haunting me and it was sticking with me. And I wanted to somehow get to that image. And the Orwell idea was sort of floating around in my head, but it wasn't really enlivened until I had that very specific image of the locust pods to orient me. And it's kind of, it's very unusual to describe this, of course, because what is the connection between these twisted locust pods and the memory of the Orwell quote, which I deliberately misremember, and I never went back and clarified for the sake of the poem what he actually said. I did for myself, but I, you know, left it sort of a part of a misremembered quotation in my own mind, you know, and it's mysterious to me how the one thing connects with the other, but that's kind of the mystery of writing, it seems to me. And just getting, you know, I started out with the Orwell and I knew I was going to the locust pods. And I just worked my way from one to the other in this sort of, just sort of scrunching my way forward from the one thing to the other and making it all coherent. And, the drama of the poem, of course, is in the middle, where you're listing the, where the speaker is listing the ways in which he was humiliated. But for me, the activity was getting to that end and somehow springing the end and making the end surprising.
So, did you intuit that the image of the locust pods would work with the Orwell quote? I mean, did you have that intuition from the beginning, or did you have to discover that along the way?
Well, I think I felt great joy when I saw those locust pods. I kind of felt this mysterious meaning filling the world out of that image itself, you know? And right. You get that with nature. And I think the intuition that came out of that was that I had to turn the poem so that it talked about joy in some way, because it was talking about humiliation. And that was pretty straightforward, writing that stuff out. And that has a lot of irony to it, of course, or it did in my mind, because in fact, I am duplicating what the Orwell quote is saying. None of those things ever happened to me. I made them up, right? Right. I still haven't told the reader my real humiliations, as Orwell says, no one does, right? You know, they're fabricated humiliations for the sake of the poem. So, and that was relatively easy to write, but I always felt that somehow obscurely I had to bring joy into it. And I think the principle was to make the transitions, right? And to give them a lot of snap, a lot of movement, that was as important as anything else. And I think that's a part of, more a part of writing a poem than it is, you know, writing something larger, writing a lyric poem. You really have to concentrate on those places where things are moving from one phase to another. That almost seems to be the central activity of the poem, the transitioning itself. So yeah, it was an obscure intuition, but I don't, you know, when I think about it, I sort of feel it was the process by which you kind of, you know, the famous anecdote about Michelangelo, that he saw the form in the piece of granite that he was making a sculpture from, and everything else was just chiseling away the pieces of the rock that didn't belong to that form. So I think I had some kind of shape in my own mind, and that I was just chiseling the material, the psychological material of and the narrative material a way that didn't belong to that shape I had.
It's so interesting hearing you talk, because I can hear how you're one of Jess's mentors. I'm thinking about earlier in the book, there's this chapter, we're talking about soundscapes, but there's a chapter where we talk about, where there's a vignette from Jess about thinking about Stendhal and thinking about her husband saying he doesn't want to have kids, and a strange man appears at the door, and these three images and how they all kind of resonate and percolate into an essay. And I'm hearing you talk, and I'm hearing about how these ideas of these disparate images and sort of finding out how they all join together. And it really resonates with a lot of stuff that I think is in this book, which is really interesting. I'm wondering if about this notion that memoir, you know, is a poem, but it's here in the anthology as an example of creative nonfiction. Right. So I'm wondering how you classify it and whether you think these terms are helpful or they get in the way. How do you look at it?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jess has probably heard this from me before. I think poetry and creative nonfiction are very close to each other, you know, and they're both somewhat removed from the short story. And I kind of feel that the open quality of a piece of essay writing, you know, it's kind of willingness to follow the movements of the mind and the movements of the heart are things that poets recognize as a part of their own practice. You know, and in fact, this poem, like the initial impulse was the image, but the condition I was in at that time was that I had been trying to write a memoir in the aftermath of publishing my book of poems, and it really got nowhere. So the poem was born out of a frustration about writing something that would be considered creative nonfiction, a memoir. And so it's called Memoir out of a inevitable frustration with the memoir form itself. And I sort of had to miniaturize the memoir form in some way and also make it ironic that I was writing about a memoir. I was writing about the material of a memoir in a poem. So there's this kind of conceptual bait and switch that was going on in my own mind. And I really was thinking about memoir writing and struggling with my experience and trying to form it into a shape and getting frustrated. And I just said, okay, I'll call this memoir. So there were a lot, that element went into it too. And I think that idea of transposing one genre onto the other is something that poets find congenial, and I think, you know, memoirists find it congenial too. And the two things are connected in some way, especially in this confessional age of poetry.
That reminds me of when I was in grad school, the poet I studied under, he refused to ever acknowledge if his poems were invented or based on his life or someone else's life. He just would always answer, it's just a poem. And as you're talking, it just made me think, do you, as you're writing, think of your poems simply as poems, or do you think if they're leaning into invention or into truth? And if you do, does that change how you write them?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's something of an anxiety-provoking question too. Because a lot of the things you do in your privacy as a writer really involves kind of making the connections that are required to get the piece of work done. And then in the aftermath, you kind of think about its relationship to both truth and verisimilitude. And by that, I mean that, for example, in a poem, you can be fictive in the way that I was in this poem, right? I list a series of humiliations which didn't occur to me, but they are somehow metaphors for other humiliations. And that metaphorical latitude you have in a poem is something that you can rely upon to finesse the notion of a strict empirical truthfulness in relationship to your life, even though the poem is saying, oh, this happened to me. And somehow the contract the reader and the poem have is that the reader is listening to this and believing it to be true, that the poet is speaking truly, right? You know, even though sophisticated readers understand that there's something else going on. I mean, if I had written an essay, I would have written it in the same way. I would have kind of used the material that I had in my mind and my life, and I would have tried to shape that into a form. But after I had done that, I would have gone back, and the places where I was playing it fast and loose with the truth, I would have fixed, right? Or I would have said it, those things in a different way to make sure I wasn't violating certain boundaries that I associate with nonfiction. That these fictive elements are not, they're fictive, but they're not fiction. They might be dramatizations. They might involve a different emphasis than the actual events would have warranted, but they somehow stay within the bounds of, factuality and verisimilitude. But that's something I do after I've finished the hard work of the writing. It's not something I do while I'm in the process of writing. While I'm in the process of writing, I don't burden myself with that kind of self-consciousness.
That's true of essay too. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's what I do with the essay. That's not what I do with the poem,
Right. Oh, that's interesting. I don't think I've ever heard anyone describe their essay process that way before.
Yeah. I mean, I'm writing an essay now, which is an introduction to Sadat Hasan Manto, a short story writer of the era of the partition of British India and India and Pakistan. And, it begins pretty fancifully. And I just kept its fancifulness. I mean, it begins with a real sort of leap that scholars would question. And I just kept it that way because it was good energy to begin the essay with, But when I finish the essay, I'm going to go back and I'm going to kind of make sure that those things that I said can be plausibly said,
Right.
And could even be true, even though what I'm doing is I'm connecting one period of North Indian history to another in a way that historians would feel was taking kind of a certain imaginative license. So it's almost like fact-checking something afterwards.
Right, but the point is that you're trying to retain that same energy that you found in what you're calling this more fanciful leap. And that there are so many ways to do that as, even as nonfiction writers, to make sure that you're not breaking the contract with the reader.
Yeah.
While also retaining whatever impulse or energetic or even rhythmic or lyrical impulse led to that leap in the first place. And I love talking about those strategies, and how we might do that. And one is the ways in which you're saying in memoir, you know, these are fictive, but they're not necessarily fictional, or right. that these examples are also metaphors for other kinds of, you know, more empirically true experiences. And and I think what for me keeps this poem under the umbrella of creative nonfiction is that even though these specific humiliations are invented, as you say, the reader knows that. I mean, that it's indicated, you know, and because the speaker says, you know, the real story of a life is the story of humiliations, if I wrote that story now. Right. And so the irony is also what keeps it attached to veracity, I think.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm just thinking that the job of the writer is not to be a historian, like you were talking about, but it's to tell the true stories of our lives as best as we can. And we're going to get lots of things wrong. We're going to misremember things, and we're going to shape our story and hide certain things or illuminate other things. And that's what the human does. So I feel like the creative nonfiction writer can follow the human. We're all, on some levels, very unreliable narrators.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, you know. I mean, the first step, I think, is the imaginative step. And then the rest of it involves your kind of rationalizing that step in relationship to what exists within the bounds of kind of plausibility, believability, persuasiveness, and stuff like that, you know? But that's sort of secondary to making this imaginative leap and to developing energy, you know? I mean, what that poem has, I would say, is the energy of narrative movement. And that's what I wanted to get down first. You know, I wanted to create a field of energy.
Well, and speaking of that energy, I'm gonna jump back towards chapter 11 and soundscapes. And in it, we talk about how sound contributes to meaning or to energy as well. And I was wondering if you could talk about how you work with sound during the writing process. And as an example, in memoir, you write, "I still wince at what I once said to the devastated widow." And we just have that beautiful series of W's, W sounds throughout. Wince, what, once, and widow. So we're just curious how you play with sound and how it affects energy and or meaning.
Yeah, I mean, I think those kind of, you know, that kind of alliteration is something that is a natural product of sort of a deeper grasping of the material, which is true in prose and poetry, which is that you establish a kind of rhythm in the prose, in the poetry, and it's out of that rhythm that language will subconsciously form chains, concatenations of sound that fit into rhythmic patterns and that emphasize them. So I've never really, that's another one of the things I don't think too much about when I'm writing. What I think about is getting a certain pace going, feeling a certain beat in the poems. You know, I remember the first long poem I wrote long, long time ago in an era before, you know, an era I know none of you could possibly remember, the era of Michael Jackson's Thriller album.
I was well out. Alive during that era.
Well,
I remember listening to it in my basement many years ago.
Right. Yeah. It came out in the early 80s, and you know, I was writing this long narrative poem, which is in my first book, about salmon fishing. And the poem was written in quatrains, but it was narrative, and I wanted to get a certain beat. So I would play Billie Jean over and over, you know, write the poem, because, you know, I wanted that ballad measure, I wanted that percussiveness, and stuff like that. And that would give me a feeling for the way I wanted the movement to go in relationship to the lines and the sentences. And I think that worked pretty effectively for the poem. I mean, with prose, you have to think about what the sound units are. You have this basic material, you have the sentence, the phrase in the sentence, and the paragraph that the sentences make up. And then you have an obligation to create a certain amount of variety. You know? And that's the same is true in poetry too, especially if you write poetry in sentences like I do, you know, that there are a series, there's a list in the middle of memoir that is emphatically rhythmic, where I list the humiliations, right? And you have a list, and you can have lists, for example, in a paragraph, and you sort of have to vary that list to make it interesting, but you also have to acknowledge that that list is building a certain amount of rhythmic power. And you have to kind of follow and develop that rhythmic power through the paragraphs, you know? I mean, when you think about sound in prose, especially in nonfiction prose, what you have to do is try to break it down into the units of sound, what the essential units are. For some people, it is the sentence. For other people, they're building larger sound structures using the paragraph, right? And they're sort of orchestrating in some way the paragraph itself and making it rhythmically round and interesting. And those are the sort of choices that are fun to think about and interesting to be aware of as you're writing. You know, because you can have, I mean, the difference between a short paragraph and a long paragraph is huge in terms of what you do with sound, right?
Right.
And so those choices are very, very interesting and important. Yeah.
In poetry, you know, there's certainly more of a tradition of thinking about sound in terms of various forms and beats.
Right.
In prose, not so much. And yet I would do the same thing. I would, especially when I early in my writing life, would listen to music often before starting to write because it would help get these a certain rhythm or beat or pattern that I wanted in the work. And I would try to apply that to the sentences. And still to this day, I write about this in the intro to this chapter a little bit, but I still like rock often when I write. You know, I tap, I sort of sit up and sit down. I do this sort of thing to, not consciously most of the time, although I'm more conscious of it now, but I guess because I'm just trying to beat out this rhythm in my body that I want to get on the page. And so I wonder, you know, are there ways that you think about sound and the units of sound as a poet that feel also applicable to prose in a more specific way?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's a fascinating question that really would require a seminar or two to get into deeply.
Right.
Now, to be practical about it, I will say this, that in terms of, say, the intellectual content of the prose that I'm writing, and I will use this essay I'm writing now as an example, my ability to get into the essay and develop it is not dependent in any way upon my understanding of the right thing to begin with logically and in terms of informing the reader about what I want to inform the reader about. My ability to begin the essay begins with a sentence that has a certain amount of rhythmic life to me. You know?
Right.
And that rhythmic life is what leads to writing a sentence that now I'm responsible for, and I have to develop the material in that sentence, even right. though it might not be logically connected to where I should begin or where, say, a historian would tell me to begin, right? You know, and that's exactly sort of the issue and the problem and the great opportunity of writing for me, that I will start out with something that I think is very alive as a sentence, you know, or as a phrase. And that says, oh yeah, that sounds right to my ear in some weird way. And I have all of this material in front of me. I have this research, I know all of this stuff, but where I begin really involves something that's purely rhythmic and has to do with soundscape.
Right, and it's that weird way that I am always trying to be more concrete about for myself and with my students. And ultimately, I don't know that that's possible. I don't have a more concrete way yet necessarily to understand that, except that so much of it feels just very intuitive and personal.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can help your students in this, that you can say, well, you're not doing expository writing, you know? Mm-hmm. That a fundamental task you have is to make this interesting to your reader. And the way you do this is to make it interesting to yourself. And one of the ways you make things interesting to yourself is to enjoy the sounds you're making on the page, right?
Right.
And just take pleasure from that and then fit the material into the overall sonic pattern that you've developed. Because the material is not rigid. The material can go in lots of places. You can move around. You're creating an open form, not a closed form when you're writing an essay. You know, you have that freedom. So you should very much be aware, you know, learn how to take pleasure in the sound of writing, first of all, and then learn how to kind of reproduce that pleasure for yourself. The things you have to say, the big ideas you have, the information you want to convey about, say, the partition of India or the nature of the Urdu language, or any of those things that are part of my essay, you know, you'll have lots of room to convey them if you create, you know, that landscape or what you call the soundscape, that those right. things will fit into that soundscape nicely. So it's a question of how you're going to prioritize. And I don't know, I mean, I can't speak for other people and how they write. The process of writing is so mysterious, but I've done it long enough to know that concentrating on sound is important. For me, you know, it's important for me to kind of hear a tune in my head, as Yeats would say, you know, just right. hear something in my head that, you know, that becomes a part of the unfolding process of the writing.
Here's a nuts and bolts question about how you hear sound on the page. And do you read your pieces out loud? Can you hear that sound when you just scan the lines? How do you hear that sound to make sure it's creating the sound that you want?
Yeah. I mean, that's another fascinating question to which I have a long answer. Yeah. But I'll try to cut it down. You know, for a long, long time, until maybe 500, 600 years after the death of Christ, people, when they read out loud, right? Their lips moved, you know. Reading without moving your lips, reading internally, is a late developing phenomenon in the history of texts. Now, what's interesting is that while they were reading silently, they were still hearing the text. And there's a difference between hearing what you're reading and just like absorbing information, right? And I think I became a writer when I started when I realized, when I started hearing what I was reading inside myself, you know. So in terms of reading aloud, I think I'm always reading aloud, but I'm reading aloud in my brain, if that makes sense to you, you know? Like that I'm actually hearing the sonic structure of what I'm reading in my brain, you know?
Yes.
Just in the way that I would be hearing if I had headphones on, if I had my, you know, Apple pods in my ear, I would be hearing the music in my brain, you know, rather than out in sound waves in the room. So the hearing process is something that's very much a part of both the reading and the writing process for me. I mean, does that make sense? I don't quite.
Explain
that clearly.
It makes complete sense, and it's something I had never realized. And as you were talking, I was just looking at some text on my computer screen, and I was practicing what you were saying, and I could just scan it and get the meaning, but no sound. But then if I pay attention, of course the words sound right in my head, and it was just a cool little experiment to try. So it works perfectly.
Yeah.
It's interesting for me to listen. You know, I think, we talk often about how a lot of creative nonfiction is coming from a poetry background, and my background is fiction. And I think that we don't often have conversations about sound and sonics in like a fiction workshop, because I think we're so busy talking about like, you know, is this character believable? Does this plot make sense? Like there's so many of those questions that I think at most you'll be like, you know, oh, the prose is lovely, you know? Right. I don't think we often will bring out like specific word choices and sonics in the same way that I imagine you would in a poetry classroom, just sort of by nature of it being poetry. So it's interesting, I think, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I don't think they do it enough in poetry classes either. You know, I mean, I think, you know, there is now this distinction between page poetry and spoken word poetry, performance poetry, which implies that page poetry is sort of a back formation, right? A retronym, like acoustic guitar. Before it was just poetry, and then it became page poetry because of performance poetry. But that kind of tends to belie the reality of what you do when you write on the page. You are creating a sonic structure, and you're hearing that sonic structure even though you're not speaking the poem aloud. And that's just as true for prose. It's totally, and it constrains you in some way to be aware of that while you're writing prose, but it also liberates you in other ways. It frees you from the tyranny of the material itself and allows you to kind of play with sounds and then let the material, as I said before, fit into the sounds or to the sonic structure that you're working on. And I mean, it's a complicated thing. I mean, I don't think we have a good psychology for understanding ourselves as writers. And it's probably good as writers that we don't, because we could psychologize ourselves into silence if, yeah, that's definitely a possibility. But I mean, I love this topic of this chapter. And I'm really glad you're concentrating on it in that way, because it's very, very important, I think, for writers to be reminded of this and to be aware of it and to sort of understand the pleasures that are available for them in thinking of themselves as people who are, you know, organizing sound on the page.
And I just love how you call that a way, you know, you use this language of, this is a way to free ourselves from the tyranny of material, right? And, you know, that the material serves the work rather than the other way around, which is really freeing. It's really liberating, you know, in in many different iterations, you know, both because you are overwhelmed by material or underwhelmed by material, or, you know, or God forbid, you know, some of my students who you know, continue to insist that they can't write creative nonfiction because they haven't had a tumultuous or disastrous or fascinating life.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So Vijay, we have to wrap up, but I wanted to ask, are there any final ideas that you'd like to share with us about memoir or your writing process or today's conversation?
Yeah, I think the one thing that I would probably derive from memoir, the poem itself, that would be useful is that once I got into the poem, and I think this is true of the essay and it's true of fiction, it's true of all writing, you think you have some momentum, but you always have to remind yourself that once you're into it, you know, that's when you do need to do something more. And I think that was the imperative when I was writing the poem. I said, oh yeah, I have this idea about humiliation. I brought Orwell into it. And I'm listing these things that are kind of, they're a little grotesque, but they're also funny. But I haven't done my work yet. I've just created momentum for myself. And now I have to do something more. Now, and I think that's something more with the idea of using the locust pods sort of allowed me to make that turn in the poem, you know, that I was seized by joy, and that was the worst of all, that kind of allowed me to exit the poem. So when you're writing, I guess the one thing I would say is just, you know, think if you're feeling really good and sort of complacent about the writing that's going on, you should probably be chastising yourself a little and saying, oh, I got to do something more. This is the time when I can't relax, where I have to intensify. And that's just a rule I've taken away whenever I write, and it's always been useful to me. And I think it derives from that poem.
That's such good advice, you know, because it is that turn in the poem that makes the poem. I mean, I don't think the poem would be nearly as successful without it.
Right.
And that's something more, you know, that something more is it born out of challenge? Are you challenging what you know, is it a direct challenge to the material that's come before, to the ideas that have come before?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think we all know that intuitively. I mean, yeah. We were talking about intuition earlier, Jess, you know, how important intuition is. You know, I think we all get to a place where we have an intuition that, okay, we're gonna sink back into all the other writing that we've done and that the world has done. And we're not, you know, and we need to individuate to a greater extent. You know? And a lot of people kind of, they just pass by that moment because they want to get what they're doing done. And, but I think after a while you realize, oh, that's the moment I was trying to get to where I really have to make a leap. So yeah, that's right. I guess look for that moment.
That's right, thank you.
Yeah.
One thing we always like to ask our guests is if they have a writing prompt they would share. Before you tell us one, you've kind of already given us two. The first one was your Billie Jean idea, which is to write a piece with a song on repeat so that song gets infused in it. And that was a wonderful idea. And then the other one was what you were just talking about, this idea of leaps and, you know, writing a piece and then make sure you toss in a big turn or a leap to get you to that driving idea you're getting at. But if you have any other prompts or if you want to expand on those, well, we'd love to hear them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, going back to this issue of soundscapes, this is something I tell my students to do when they feel they don't have anything to write about. They're stuck. They don't have an idea. I tell them that, well, you know, you're concentrating too much on the notion of an idea and you're being tyrannized by material. I want you to take a walk from here to the bodega and then write about what happened inside your mind and what you saw on that walk. If you sort of accept that material is somehow tyrannical, you will be able to get to the point where you can write something fascinating just about that, you know, just about starting with, I walked down the stairs and opened the door and the mail was there in the mailbox and I did this and that. And before you know it, you will be generating material that will be made interesting by the sounds you bring to it, by the impressions you bring to the writing in a very, very small way. And you know, and I say that, well, you can, if you are sufficiently the master of your craft, you should be able to make the most ordinary, everyday things fascinating to us. And that's an exercise you should put to yourself. And the old Seinfeld thing, you know, Seinfeld was a show about nothing. Sometimes I tell my students, yeah, just write about nothing.
I love that.
They get a little baffled, but, you know, and then I explain it to them in the way that I did. And I don't know if that's going to be helpful or a hindrance to students, but it tends to work out, or at least it frees people in order to think about writing in a different way than they usually do.
Yeah. I try to insist upon something similar, and I think it's helpful for the right student at the right time.
Right.
And it might be helpful to the others later. Yeah. So thank you so much, Vijay, for this conversation. It was just a great reminder to me of why you are such a wonderful writer and teacher of writing. And thanks so much to everyone for joining us as we explore the central questions of creative nonfiction. You can rate and review The Central Question. You can feel free to follow Sean and Jess at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And also don't forget that you can buy our textbook, Advanced Creative Nonfiction, and visit our website for more resources. Have a great day and keep essaying.